Hello and welcome. You are tuned into another episode of Mountain Song and Story right here on Radio Bristol, the very last episode of the year. I'm your host, Tony Doman, and with a year like none other, and despite the countless challenges that 2020 has left us with, I've still had a lot of fun putting together these programs all about Appalachian culture, folklore, and music and storytelling. And I've still been able to have numerous guests via phone interviews. And I really can't wait to be physically back in the Radio Bristol studio and broadcasting live. But until then, I'll still be bringing you new episodes of Mountain Song and Story each and every week into 2021. The new year is going to bring more talks with storytellers, and I am so excited and looking forward to that. And if you'd like to suggest a topic, or if you might have an idea for a show, please let me know. You can get in contact me via the Contact Us section on the Birthplace of Country Music website. Now, getting into the spirit of Christmas, today's guest is Michael Reno Harrell, an award-winning songwriter as well as a veteran storyteller and entertainer from the Southern Appalachian Mountains. Michael's recordings have for years received and continue to garner awards in country, Americana, and folk circles. His humor and wit, as well as the emotional depth of his work, keep his fan base growing and staying tuned in for whatever comes next. I'll be talking with Michael today on the program about his life and his career in storytelling. And stick around and stay tuned, because I'll also be airing a wonderful, humorous Christmas tale from Michael later on in the show off of his album Humor and Heart, called Sledding Shepherds. It's fantastic. First up, here's a song to get things started from our guest today, Me and You by Michael Reno Harrell.
It rained every day for a week. We had pots and pans and cans everywhere there was a leak. The sheetrock in the living room came down in one big sheet on the couch and the TV and you and me. I tell you what we need to do. Remember that above the clouds the sky is always blue. And if I was a betting man, I'd tell you what I'd do. I'd bet it all on me and you. We put every dime we had in that old car, but it's getting hard to count on, cause it's getting hard to start. We're better off to walk these days if it ain't all that far to the place we gotta be, you and me. I tell you what we need to do. I remember that above the clouds the sky is always, and if I was a betting man, I'd tell you what I'd do. I'd bet it all on me and you. Another drop of rain. Forget evacuation, that old car won't stand the strain, but we'll make do. We'll make it through, me and you. I tell you what we need to do. I remember that above the clouds the sky is always blue. And if I was a betting man. I tell you what I do, I bet it all on me and you. If I was a betting man, I tell you what I'd do, I'd bet it all on me and you.
So joining me now is storyteller and musician Michael Reno Harrell. Michael, it is so great to have you here on the show with me today. I'm so excited to be speaking with you here for a bit. You have this wonderful Christmas story from your CD, Humor and Heart, that I will be playing. Yeah, I'll be playing that here in just a bit. But before we get to that, tell me a little bit about yourself. Where are you from originally, and when did you really begin your career in music and storytelling? What got you into this field?
Well, I usually open my shows by saying that, more information than you require, I was conceived in North Carolina and born in Tennessee, so I'm bilingual. But I grew up, my parents are both from North Carolina, from the Blue Ridge, from the mountains. My dad's from Mitchell County, my mom's from Buncombe County, which, as probably most of your listeners know, is where Asheville is. My dad and mom moved to Tennessee the year I was born. My dad took a job with a textile plant over there, a rayon plant, in Morristown, Tennessee, and that's where I grew up. And the way I got started in this business was probably because of my mother's love for music. Nobody else in my family played. One of her sisters played the piano just a little bit, and she was a pretty decent piano player. But other than that, not many people in that generation played. However, my grandfather, my mom's dad, played the banjo, and his brother played the fiddle, and they played all over the mountains around Asheville. So there's that in there. His brother, actually, Furman Cole, was a North Carolina state fiddle champion 3 times. So they had a really good band. They played for the tourists in Asheville and that sort of thing back in at the turn of the century. My dad's brother was a bass player. He played with, he had a little radio show in Spartanburg, South Carolina back in the day in the 30s and 40s. And a couple of guys came through. And they were on their way to the midday merry-go-round, a big radio show in Knoxville, Tennessee, that some of your listeners may be familiar with. Mm-hmm. It was sort of one of those programs that was like the Louisiana Hayride or the Chicago Barn Dance or the Wheeling Jamboree. Yeah. If you could make it there, you might get a shot at the Opry. And these boys turned out to be Charlie and Ira Leuven.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, so he went to the Opry later on with those boys, and then as all your listeners know, there's that little door out of the back of the Ryman that went right across that little alley into the back door of Tootsie's Orchid Lounge, and I think they named that pathway after my uncle after a while, because he sure used it a lot. But anyway, he would hang out in the back room at Tootsie's, and he started hanging out with this little guy from West Virginia called Little Jimmy Dickens. Jimmy hired him away, and he played bass with on the road for years with the Major Opry Act. And anyway, that generation sort of, I guess it skipped a generation, and then I'm the only one out of 15 cousins that really got into music. And of course, I was going to be a jazz drummer until I heard the Kingston Trio sing Tom Dooley, and I traded my snare drum for a guitar Charlie's Pawn Shop in Knoxville, in Morristown, Tennessee. And I came back in the house with that guitar. My mother looked at me and looked at the guitar and kissed me on the mouth. she was tickled that I wasn't going to be a drummer and turned out to be a guitar player. So I started playing folk music, and I had a girl that had moved to my high school from New York, and she had actually been to Greenwich Village, and she had a wonderful collection of records, and so she and I formed a little duo. And the first time I got paid was with her. We did a little show in Rogersville, Tennessee at the high school, and they paid us $5 in 1963. And when they handed me that $5, I was like, I know what I'm going to do. And that's what I did. I've been playing music. And of course, when I first started in folk music, there was that idea that folk music had to be real folk music. It had to be, you know, a child ballad or something, you know. And then Bob Dylan said, nah, and kicked that door right down. And then basically most everybody in the folk world was a singer-songwriter. And so I tried to write songs. Finally wrote my first song, and I managed to rhyme Blue Eyes and Your Thighs. And
talent right there, yeah.
Yeah. Oh, it was a hit, I'll tell you. But I got better. I you know, got better at it. And so the places that I knew where music was, once the Beatles came in 64, folk music pretty much got flushed from the mainstream. So, you know, I was looking for places to play, and the only places I knew that people had live music were bars. So I started going to bars and restaurants, and played to seafood restaurants up and down the East Coast, Merle's Inlet and Savannah and those places. And then kept trying to sing some of my songs. And every time I would, they'd say, well, hey, play something we like, you know, like John Prine or, you know, all right. My heroes. So I thought, well, maybe if I tell them a story about how I wrote the song, people would be more interested in listening to the song. So I started doing that and did that for a long time, and it was working. People would seem to be more interested in listening to the song after I told them a little story about it. I had met David Holt in 1969, the first time he came out from California at the Asheville Mountain Dance and Folk Festival, and we've been friends ever since. David, I knew David did a lot of shows at schools and those sorts of things. And we were writing songs together down in on the coast of South Carolina. He and his wife had a place down there for years at Seabrook. We were writing songs, and he kept telling me, man, you ought to get into storytelling. And I'm like, I don't have anything for kids. He said, well, it's mostly for adults. And I didn't really grasp what he was saying until I was in Texas one night on tour and came in to the motel room after a show and got that little card on the nightstand that listed the TV channels looking for PBS, thinking maybe Austin City Limits might be on. And I turned on the television, and there was this little gray-haired lady with this amazing Alabama accent talking about taking piano lessons in a little town called Thomasville, Alabama, where she'd grown up. And it was just mesmerizing. And she was standing in a tent. It was obvious, a yellow and white striped tent, and all these people in folding chairs just listening to her every syllable. And I was just mesmerized. And at the end of it, they said, you've been listening to excerpts from the National Storytelling Festival in Jonesboro, Tennessee. And I'd grown up 53 miles from that tent she was talking in, and had never heard of that. And so I called Joan, my wife, who's been my manager and booking agent for 25 years now. I said, I don't know when the National Storytelling Festival is, but find out when it is, and whatever we got booked, cancel it, because we're going. And she just went, okay, went back to sleep. And the next year we went, and I met Catherine Windham. I just wanted to hear her. That's the only reason I went. And, of course, you had to sit through all these other people to get to her. And I kept going, wow, these people are good, too. Wow, these people are good, too. And then I found out what, you know, professional storytelling was. And 3 years later, I was on the show.
Wow. Yeah. You have a really great story. How do you find that it's Well, I guess with the pandemic going on right now, I know you've had a ton of canceled shows, and it's can be really challenging for musicians and storytellers and anyone that really is in a performance career like you are. How do you feel you're handling engaging without an audience right now, and how many shows have you had to cancel, and what kind of challenges have you faced this year? It's been tough.
Yeah, we normally do a couple hundred days a year on the road. And when I came home on Friday the 13th, should have known, Friday the 13th, I just done a festival in Alabama, the Azalea Storytelling Festival, which is one of the best in the country, in LaGrange, Georgia, excuse me, not Alabama. And I came into the house, and with by the end of that week, we had lost about a year and a half's worth of booking. We lost at least 150 shows.
Wow, that's awful.
Well, it is, but there, you know, I'm not the only one in that boat.
Right.
But so I just went to work writing. You know, I've got a studio here off on the on our property that I go to every day and work. And I've made my living when I wasn't, or also at times that I was performing music. I made my living with a pencil. I was a graphics designer for a good deal of my life, off and on. And so I just started drawing pictures again and putting them on the internet, and they sort of caught on, and people have really, I do a lot of instrument peg heads. I do kids' portraits. I do dogs. I do whatever, pocket knives. People sort of caught on to it, and I've probably sold 20 pieces in the last few months, which has helped, our income, but just, you know, trying to stay busy with the art, you know, creating new stuff. And hopefully with the vaccine that's coming out, maybe, you know, in the next, who knows, few months to a year, we'll, things will be back to normal enough to, that we can get back out there, you know.
Yeah.
But it's just a matter of hunkering down, you know, like everybody else.
Absolutely. You got to stay safe out there, because I think everybody wants music and entertainment to come back. And I really can't wait for that. I'm really looking forward to next year.
Oh, I think, yeah, the world is.
Yeah.
We all are. You know.
Go ahead.
I'm 72. So I'm in that age group where I haven't been anywhere. We've not been, you know, we've taken some drives up on the Blue Ridge Parkway and those sort of things, but we haven't really been out in buildings anywhere, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I haven't been in a building I didn't own maybe once or twice in the last year or so.
Yeah. So one thing that your bio mentions here, I really like this line that you have in your bio. It says, your brand of entertainment appeals to a very diverse audience, and a typical day for you might include a program of fourth graders in the afternoon to a concert for a mixed audience in the evening. And when you are actually playing shows, that is, how are you able to really connect to such a diverse audience through storytelling? It feels like storytelling is one of those things that kind of crosses barriers and really connects people at all ages.
Well, I've always maintained that it's in our DNA to listen to stories anyway. I mean, you know, think about, I mean, in the 1500s, they came out with the Gutenberg press, but not many people could read, much less afford a book. That was for the clergy pretty much, you know, or royalty. So people, all information was passed along in story form, basically. We talked to each other, you know. And think about it, radio didn't come along until the 20s, really, the late 20s. Phonographs, you know, a little bit earlier than that. But before that, everything was just oral tradition, you know. Live music was the music, and live stories were these stories, you know. So I think it's sort of in our DNA to listen to stories. Now, when you become a professional storyteller, or whatever you want to call that, when you start working, you know, I've always maintained that being a professional storyteller is almost like being in a bluegrass band, because that almost all the work is festival work. And it's the same thing in bluegrass music. Almost all your work is going to be festivals. And it's pretty much that way in the storytelling world. That's where we make our money, is at festivals. And just because, you know, and at festivals, if you go to the National Storytelling Festival in Jonesboro, it's just it's like every other storytelling festival. The average age is probably 58. Mm-hmm. But they're not kids. They're hardly ever do you see any kids in the audience at a festival. However, what they do is they bring you in during earlier in the week, and they get grants to put you in schools. So you do schools like at the Athens Storytelling Festival in Athens, Alabama. They bring 9,000 kids over 3 days to the tent there. They got a tent that seats 1,400. You talk to 9,000 kids over a three-day period. That material has to be totally different than what you tell adults typically. So you have to be able to, you know, like anything else, you have to be able to speak to your audience. Kids, you know, if you're doing first graders want something to say back to you. They want to be involved. Little kids want to be involved. You have to sing a song with them, teach them a song or something. So by the time you get to middle school, by the time kids get about 10 years old, they get abstract concepts so you can tell them jokes. Yeah. So, and then high schoolers, you just have to come out with your guns blazing because they don't want to hear you anyway. What's this old guy got to say to me? So I usually tell stories about blowing up mailboxes and things like that, you know, pyrotechnics. But it's just a matter, if you're going to be a storyteller, you have to be able to know who your audience is and talk to them. You know, that's just part of it. So you got to have material for all age groups, pretty much. By and large, festival work and audiences that are basically, you know, older audiences, mostly personal stories and nostalgia. Mm-hmm. Kids don't know what nostalgia is, so you can't do that, you know. So it's just a matter of being able to, you know, walk on several different tightropes, you know.
Yeah. What's, where do you pull some of your influences when putting some stories together for your performances? And I also have a question about memory. I know, you know, I'm a musician as well, so it's really easy to remember a song and a story in a song. But when it comes to performances like at the International Storytelling Festival, people get up there and they're up there for an hour or 45 minutes. And it's really interesting to me to think about how you can remember without any note cards or anything. How do you handle that?
Oh, well, it's just like when you learn a song, the repetition, you know, and knowing the story. I don't, and most of us who do this, you don't recite a story, you just talk about it. I just get up, my method is I just get up there and tell you about what I know about this. And I know that I need to go from point A to point B to point C to point D and end up at E. So what I do is just like, if you memorize a trail through the mountains and for some reason you get off the trail, you're lost. But if you memorize landmarks and you sort of get, you know, you sort of get to a place where, okay, what's next? You just go, I know I have to go to that mountain over there. And how you get there doesn't matter as long as it's an interesting route. So it's just, you hit the high points. You go from point A to point B to point C. And you know, after you tell a story enough, most of us who do this, and Bill Lepp down to Andy, or over to Andy Offit Irwin, to Kim Whitecamp, to all of us who do this, so many of us, you create a story and you get pretty much everything down. And you take it to the stage. We may put it up in front of our friends and just see, what do you think, you know, this quarter, before you put it on the stage. Then you put it on the stage and it works. But if you haven't memorized it, if you're just telling the story, if you leave yourself open to just tell the story, things will come out of your mouth that you weren't planning. Just like I said, I was conceived in North Carolina, born in Tennessee. For a long time, that got a laugh. And then one day I said, so I'm bilingual. And that got a bigger laugh. So now the first part is the setup to the second part, because I allowed my mind to just be open to say whatever came to me. So if you have any sort of wittiness about you, let that happen. And a year later, that story will be 30% better because the audience tells you everything you need to know about your performance. If you tell them something funny and they don't laugh, then just because you thought it was funny doesn't mean it is. The audience is the judge. So if the audience laughs, keep that. If they don't laugh, try it one more time, maybe. But if they don't laugh at the next performance, scrap it. Just because you think it's funny doesn't mean it is, or poignant. And another thing is the audience gives you your timing. If I work really hard to get a laugh and they're laughing, I shut up until they quit laughing. If I give them something poignant, something to stir heartfelt memories, a story about a mother or a grandfather or a dog, and I say something that you can see them sort of take that breath, then I've given them something to chew on. I'm going to let them chew on it till I, you know, that's the audience. Audiences are as different as people. Audiences have personalities. It depends on how there's a mood there that you can somehow sometimes influence. So what you're trying to do is read the audience, and, you know, you might go on stage thinking, okay, I'm going to tell this story, this story, and this story. After the first story, you know, okay, the second story is not, that's not the one. So while you're telling that first story, you're searching your memory banks going, okay, they want to be more sedate. They want to think more, or they want to laugh more. So go that direction with them, you know. It's just, but it's all experience, you know. It's just you either have, you know, you have to have some, obviously you have to have some talent for that, but.
Well, you're very inspiring just hearing you with all these storytelling tips. I want to get out there. I'm usually asking the questions, so it's great to hear some tips behind to make the magic happen.
One other thing about storytelling that's unique as far as a performance art or an art form goes, it's the only art form that I'm aware of that if you get any good at it, it's expected that you'd be able to teach it. Because a lot of storytelling festivals, they'll say, they won't say, would you like to do a workshop? They'll say, which of your workshops would you like to do?
Wow. I guess so, I didn't really realize that. Yeah.
Well, the analogy of being a storyteller in a bluegrass band goes to that too. If you go to a bluegrass festival, usually about 50% of the people coming through the gate have got an instrument in their car. You know, they're going to be jamming after the festival. Storytellers are the same way. When you go to a storytelling festival, a lot of those people in the audience want to learn how to tell a better story. It's the most common workshop that a lot of us get. The two most common ones would be collecting family stories and how to tell a ghost story. Because a lot of people want to collect their family stories, and a lot of people want to, you know, you don't have to learn to play the guitar to be able to do this. You don't have to, you know, everybody's got stories. We all have stories, and people want to hear each other's stories. So people are interested. When I teach at John Campbell Folk School for a week, or at Wild Acres for a week, people go, how in the world can you take a week to talk about using humor and storytelling? Well, I wondered that the first time I did a week too, until the gal who was running it, Diane Ackworth, a good friend of mine, she runs it. She said, we're all storytellers. Just turn us loose and try to shut us up. So it's you know, the things that the crafts that people love, whether it's whittling or bass fishing, you love to get together with like-minded people and talk about that. And people who are interested in the storytelling like to get together and talk about it and try to learn, how can I be a better storyteller? And they're, you know, the Jonesboro Storytelling Guild, the Asheville Storytelling Circle, they meet once a month. You know, the Asheville group meets once a month, and it's 2 hours of just everybody telling stories. There's no business meeting, none of that. There might be an announcement or two, but it's like, okay, let's get to it. And you swap stories for 2 hours. There's a, you know, people are very interested in, how do you do that? How can I do that? And again, you don't even have to learn to play the guitar. I mean, if you're a singer-songwriter, you probably need to learn to play the guitar or the piano at least. But if you want to be a storyteller, it's just a matter of talking about your life.
Yeah, I can say again, you've been very inspiring talking with you here today. And we are we are running a little bit short on time. We definitely want to leave room after this to play your Christmas story that we've got off of your CD, Humor and Heart. And I wanted to talk to you a bit about that track. It okay. is called, well, just tell me a little bit about it. How do you kind of incorporate humor in these stories? And it is, this is our Christmas program for the year. So we're in a very festive mood here and I'm excited to get to that Christmas story. Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, it all started, there's a lot of truth in it. And of course, there's a lot of embellishment as well, but it turns into sort of a tall tale as y'all will probably notice as it goes along. But when I was a senior in high school, the seniors got to put on the nativity pageant for we had one high school in our whole county, and the seniors got to every year put on the Christmas pageant, and I got to be in the Christmas pageant. I was a shepherd, so I didn't, as I say in the story, I didn't have to say anything, but I just had to be sore afraid, and I could do that, you know. Me and two of my buddies were the shepherds, and we wore, you know, bathrobes and glued on beards, you know, and that in itself was funny to just look back on, you know, because, you know, so many high school pageants are pretty corny, you know.
They can leave room for good stories later in life.
Yes,
I think.
Yes. So it started there, just, you know, just the idea of, well, gosh, every place has got a Christmas pageant, you know, typically of some kind, you know, there's some sort of Christmas pageant for years and years. And so the idea just started there. I'll just talk about mine and see where it goes, and that story almost wrote itself. But again, that story has grown over the years because I leave myself open to ad lib, you know. So if you hear me tell that story now, it'll be the same story but with different scenarios happening too, you know. So.
Right. Yeah. Well, Michael, thank you so much for talking with me today. I
really
appreciate
it. Well, thank you, Tony.
Yeah, we're gonna go ahead and play that track off of your CD, Humor and Heart, right now. You take care, and I hope you all have a great day walking.
Oh, thanks, and Merry Christmas to everybody.
The little town I grew up in, Morristown, I was talking about, we had two of everything, but we just had one high school in the whole county. And that meant we had a pretty good sized high school. We had pretty good football teams all the time. Pretty decent basketball teams. About 2,000 students, and we'd graduate 40 or 50 every year. Remember I said it was a furniture town, right? But the greatest pageant that we had in our hometown was every year the senior class put on the nativity pageant in front of the high school. A live nativity pageant, and everybody would show up for it. And so every year the senior class would try to outdo the previous year. Well, the year that I became a senior, it was wonderful. We had the greatest pageant. And what would happen was, you know, like all the members, all the people in the pageant would be voted on by the members of the school there, you know, the students. And so it became sort of a popularity contest, you know, like the high echelon there was, of course, your archangel that come down and give the good tidings, you know. Well, they had to sing the good tidings, so that was always the best female singer in the glee club, right? And then if you were in the Glee Club, you automatically got in because they had to have the Angel Chorus back there. And so they automatically were in, and they had white choir robes anyway, so it was perfect for the angels, right? And of course, she would always get that little coat hanger halo, you know. And they would put like a stepladder up behind the manger where she could appear, you know, and give the good tidings. So that was always the best singer. And then, of course, Mary and Joseph, that's a shoo-in right there. Best actor and actress right there is going, they, you know. So you would think that, but the thespians had nothing to do with it because, like I say, it was a popularity contest. So it was always the captain of the football team was Joseph. And for some reason, the virgin was always played by the head cheerleader. Yeah. And then the year that we had the pageant there when I was a senior, of course, the three big richest guys, and they were always elected to be the wise men. See, the three wise men. And then way down on the lower echelon of the people in the pageant were the three shepherds. And that was always the class clowns. So that year it was Don Britton, Joe Pearson, and yours truly. Now, if you had one of the big parts in the pageant, see, they tried to get the whole school involved. The home ec girls would make your costumes. So, you know, they did the coat hanger halo and the wings for the archangel what gave the glad tidings, you know. And then they made these really nice outfits for the three wise men with brocade, you know, and all. And then the shop class made, like, the gifts that they would bring, you know, with gold trim and everything. It was lovely. And then of course, the cosmetic class, the girls learning to do cosmetology, would do Mary up just, you know, just she looked good. And then and then it got down to the three shepherds, and we were on our own. So. So we just would wear, you know, our dad's bathrobes, right, and then a towel on your head. And then Don Britton's mother had nice drapes in her house, and she had those cords that tie back the drapes. And put them on the towel over your head. And then we thought, you know what we need? We got to, I mean, this is old time. We need beards. So the three of us, we were cowboys. We all had horses. So we went out with the scissors, bobbed the tails off our three horses, and then took Elmer's glue and glued that to our faces. And we had some good-looking beards. Joe Pearson was the only pinto shepherd in that the pageant had ever had, but we were looking good. Now, the shop class, they got together with the carpentry class, and they went down to the local sawmill and got sawmill slabs and built a beautiful stable with like six stalls in it, and that was looking good. And then the FFA boys, they brought in about 15 sheep. And I don't know if y'all had one of these at your nativity pageant, but we had a javelina hog. Some of you are familiar with that breed. And, you know, to top it all off, right there, the morning, the Saturday, which was Christmas Eve, by the way, the Saturday of the pageant, it started snowing. And it snowed, it's just a beautiful snow, about 13 to 14 inch snow. And the city, there was just like, they were so excited about that they got out and cleared all the roads. And so everybody was able to get there. And it was beautiful, Bethlehem in the snow. You know, and everybody said that it was by far the best nativity pageant that the city had ever put on. And it was just, as a matter of fact, Helm McClister, who owned the local dairy farm, came over and announced that all the seniors from the high school were invited out to his dairy farm out by the Leadville River to sled on his big pasture. He had the best hill in town, see? But he never would let a sled out there on account of somebody's daddy was a lawyer one time, and you know how that went. Anyway, so he had knocked that off. Well, now, the year before, we had all gone out to the country club, and the 13th fairway was pretty good sledding, except we found out that once you burn a truck tire on somebody's golf green, you don't get invited back there either, see? So we were really excited that Mr. McClister had invited us all out to sled at his big long hill there, and it was beautiful because it was like flat on the top, and then it just come off this beautiful long slope, about 150 yards, maybe 200 yards, beautiful slope, then flattened right out at the bottom, and there's a big oak tree and beautiful place to build like a fire, you know, a bonfire, and then right behind that was the Leadville River, just picturesque in the moonlight, you know, and we thought, this is how much better could it get than this right here, you know? So I said to Joe and Don, I said, boys, since we're down here on the lower level of the characters in the nativity, I think what we ought to do is make a big entrance at the sledding party. And Don says to me, what did you have in mind? And I said, well, now y'all know that I work part-time down at Buck Brown and Shorty Gray's sign company. Buck Brown and Shorty Gray, two of the greatest influences in my life, got me into the graphics business. But the name of their company was Brown and Gray Signs. If I'm lying, I'm dying. Every time somebody would call up, the first thing they'd say was, do they come in any other color? I said, now, boys, you know I work for Buck and Shorty down there. I said, you know what we did just last month? They said, no, what? I said, we made a new sign for the Knee-High Bottling Company down there on Main Street. And what we did was we made them one of them big, internally illuminated, aluminum cabinet, plexiglass face signs that said Knee-High Bottling Company, Morristown, Tennessee on it. But what I'm talking about is we took down the old sign. Do y'all remember that? And they said, oh, yeah. It was like an 8-foot diameter, 3-dimensional, knee-high grape bottling cap. I said, that thing's sitting out there behind Buck and Shorty's shop. What we need to do is keep our shepherd's outfits on. And once everybody's sledded down to the bottom of the hill, we make our entrance sledding down the hill on an 8-foot diameter, knee-high great bottle sign with our shepherd costumes on. Well, yeah. So everybody splits and they take off for Hal McClister's hill out there. Me and my buddies, we head over to Buck and Shorty's. We load the big 8-foot diameter knee-high grape sign in the back of Joe's truck, and we drive out there, and we wait till everybody's at the bottom of the hill, and they're all standing around the fire. And I said, all right, boys, turn the lights out. We snuck right up to the top of the hill. We unloaded that sign real quiet-like, and I said, wait just a minute. And I looked around under the seat, and I found a piece of rope about that long, and I tied it through the edge of the thing there and around my left wrist like this. I said, all right, now this is, I'm going to stand here in the middle, right? Okay. Okay, now, Joe, I want you to stand on my left, okay? Well, Joe got on my left. I said, now put your right hand on my left shoulder. Joe put his, I said, now hold your left arm straight out, all right? Don, you get on the right side. He got his right arm stuck out. I said, all right. And I held my right arm up like this. We were making the sign of the cross, say Christmas. I said, y'all ready? They were standing aboard. I said, now, Joe, give us just a little push off there. And Joe, he's a big, long-legged thing anyway. He was my shoulder, and he had his arm out there. And he reached back and just gave a little shove, and there we went over the bridge. Well, we was going about 30 miles an hour when all of a sudden somebody down there at the campfire looked up and their eyes got real big and they started doing this. And pretty soon everybody was looking at us and cheering. And here we come, the three sledding shepherds down the hill. And we was going about 60 by now. And I had that loop around my arm, and my arm up, and Joe to have him get like it. And I heard Joe say to Donna, "How are we going to stop?" Don said, "I don't know, bail out." Well, they left. And I had that dang rope around my arm, and I looked up, and here come the bonfire at me at about 75 miles an hour. Boom! I hit the bonfire, and I was blinded, and sparks flew, and smoke, and everything. And I was, and all of a sudden, I heard splash. And I looked down, and I was standing in a shepherd's costume in the middle of an 8-foot diameter, knee-high grape bottle cap floating in the middle of the Leadville River. And I looked back, and there's the entire senior class going. And I thought, how am I going to get to shore? Because the current was keeping me right in the middle of the river, and I just floated right out of what was left of the bonfire into the darkness, and I was standing there going, this ain't good right here. Because I wasn't but about a mile and a half from the Leadville River Bridge. And once you go under that bridge, you float out into the middle of Douglas Lake. And I thought, if I can't get to shore some way, I'm going to float under the Leadville River Bridge out into the middle of the lake, and some duck hunter's going to find me in the morning. And he ain't going to tell anybody, because who would come in from a hunting trip and say, y'all ain't going to believe what I found? His wife never let him go duck hunting again, you know? And I thought, well, maybe I could paddle. If I could just get, so I started over toward the edge, and as I did, the bottle cap started listing, and I thought, oh, Lord, if it gets water in it, I'm sunk. And this water couldn't be but about 33 degrees. And I thought, oh, Lord, what am I going to do? And then I thought, I've got one chance, because there's one house right before that curve that gets you down to the Leadville River Bridge where Hoke and Mary Wilson live. If I go by Hoke and Mary's house and I scream, maybe they... And then I thought, no, that ain't going to work, because it's Saturday night. And for the last 23 years, every Saturday night, Hoke Wilson's been drunk and passed out. By this time of night, he won't hear me. And Mary, bless her heart, is deaf as a post, and she's got Lawrence Welk turned up on 11. And then I thought, my feet are sure cold. And I picked up my left foot, and he went, and I went, oh, no, my bottle caps are leaking. And sure enough, there's about 2.5 inches of water had already leaked in there, and I was going, oh, my foot's cold. Oh, my foot's cold. Oh, my foot's cold. So I was going down the river going, what in the world am I going to do? What in the world am I going to do? And I thought, well, there ain't but one thing to do, and that's yell just as loud as you can when you pass Hoke and Mary Wilson's house. And I thought, I know, I'll yell, help, help, I need a rope. Somebody throw me a rope. And then I thought, no, if I say that, it's just too confusing. They'll think probably somebody's run off in the ditch in front of the house. They'll go out the front of the house if they heard me. And then I would float by, and it'd be, I just, no, that ain't going to work. I'll just get it down to the basics. Rope, rope, I'll yell, rope. No, wait a minute, that ain't enough. They'll think somebody's stuck in the... Need a rope quick, go. Rope quick! That ain't enough. They won't. Yeah, I'm out here in the middle of the river, and I'm about to go under. Rope quick, sinking. Rope! That's what I'll do. I'll yell, rope quick, sinking. Just as loud as I can. That's as plain as I can make it. Oh, Lord, please. Please, God, please, please, please. Just let them hear me when I go by. Just let them hear me in time. Oh, I need a miracle. I need a Christmas miracle if there was ever a new... I need a Christmas miracle right now. Please, please, if there's any chance. And I come around the corner right where their place was, and just as I started around the corner, I was just maybe 50 yards from their house, and the back porch light come on, and I saw Hoke walk out onto the back porch, and I thought, it's a miracle. He ain't drunk and passed out. this is just exactly what I need. He's come out. What's he? Wonder why he's on the back porch. And I noticed there's a big pile of firewood there with the tarpaulin on it. I thought, thank you, Lord, you've sent him out for firewood just when I need him. And he reached down in that firewood, and instead of getting a piece of firewood, he pulled up a bottle of Jack Daniels. Unscrewed the lid on it and throwed the lid out there toward the creek and turned that bottle up like that in big bubbles. Like, look up in that bottle. And I thought, well, at least he ain't passed out. Maybe I've got a chance. So all of a sudden I yelled, rope, quick, sinking. Rope, quick, sinking. And he looked out there at me floating down the Leadville River in the middle of that bottle cap. And he went and poured that liquor right out in the snow and watched me float out of sight around the curve. And I thought, well, so much from a Christmas miracle. That duck hunter's going to find me tomorrow. Froze to death out there in the middle of Douglas Lake. But just as I come around the corner there, I looked, and there was 14 sets of headlights shining on that bridge, and the entire senior class standing there on both sides of the river and had six ropes stretched across it. You couldn't have shot a BB through that bridge. And I grabbed one of them ropes, and Don Britton started pulling, and I was a-hanging on, and I stepped to shore just as that knee-high bottle cap sank out from under me right onto dry land. And I said, if there was ever a Christmas miracle, I've experienced it here tonight. So you can bet your life the next morning I was sitting on the third row from the back of the Cherokee Baptist Church. And the preacher that morning got up and he said, I want to preach on the miracle of Christmas. He said, because some of you may know we have a Christmas miracle sitting right here in the back of the church today. And I thought, well, he's probably going to call on me to stand up and give a little talk. He said, I wonder if we could get our Christmas miracle to stand up and say a few words. And you know how when you're in a crowd and you see somebody waving and you go, are they waving at me? And I looked at the preacher and he was looking like right here. And I was going. And I turned around and look, and there said Hulk on the back seat. And the preacher said, it's been 23 years since Hulk Wilson darkened the door of the Baptist church here, Hulk. He said, I wonder if you'd stand up and testify just a little bit for the folks. And Hulk stood up and he said, y'all ain't gonna believe this. He said, last night, as I always do, I had me a bottle of that evil Jack Daniels stashed in a wood pile on the back porch of my house. And I went out there, and I took the lid off of it, and I turned it up, and I was drinking that stuff just as fast as I could get it down my gullet. And I looked out onto the Leadville River, and I saw Jesus walking down the Leadville River. And he looked directly at me, and he said, Hope! Quit drinking. So that year I witnessed a miracle and I got to initiate one, I guess. Caused one to happen. That's good. Thank you.
All right, you just heard Sledding Shepherds off of the album Humor and Heart from Michael Reno Harrell. And thank you so much for tuning in. Remember, you can catch Mountain Song and Story on Thursdays at 4 o'clock right here each and every week on Radio Bristol. You can also check out past shows if you visit the Mountain Song and Story program blog page over at listenradiobristol.org. As always, I've got all the songs and materials and information from our guest today up there after the show, so go check it out, listenradiobristol.org. Special thanks again to our guest, Michael Reno Harrell, for helping me out and speaking with me today. It's been a pleasure talking with him. Thank you so much for tuning in. I'm going to leave you today with one more song. Got a little Christmas song for you. After all, it is fitting with the time of year. Old Toy Trains from Roger Miller.
Old toy trains, little toy tracks, little boy toys coming from a sack, carried by a man dressed in white and red. Little boy, don't think it's time you were in bed. Close your eyes, listen to the skies. All is calm, all is well. Soon you'll hear Kris Kringle and the jingle bells, bringing old toy trains, little toy tracks, little boy toys coming from a sack, carried by a man dressed in white and red. Little boy, don't think it's time you were in bed. Close your eyes. Jingle bells bringing old toy trains, little toy tracks, little boy toys coming from a sack, carried by a man dressed in white and red. Little boy, don't think it's time you were in bed.